Liberty by John Stuart Mill, first published in 1859. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 4. The Limits to Society's Authority Over the Individual. What, then, is the rightful limit to the sovereignty of the individual over himself? Where does the authority of society begin? How much of human life should be assigned to individuality, and how much to society? Well, to individuality should belong the part of life that chiefly involves the interests of the individual. To society, the part that chiefly involves the interests of society. Though society is not based on a contract, and though no good purpose is served by inventing a contract so as to infer social obligations from it, everyone who receives the protection of society owes society something in return for this benefit, and the sheer fact that they have a society makes it indispensable that each should be bound to conform to a certain line of conduct towards the rest. This conduct consists in two things. First, not harming the interests of one another, or rather, not harming certain particular interests which ought to be classified, by explicit law or tacit understanding, as rights. Second, doing one's share, to be fixed by some fair principle, of the labours and sacrifices incurred for defending the society, or its members, from injury and harassment. Society is justified in enforcing these conditions at the expense of those who try to avoid fulfilling them. Nor is this all that society may do. The acts of an individual may be hurtful to others, or lacking in proper consideration for their welfare, without going so far as violating any of their constituted rights. The offender may then be justly punished by opinion, though not by law. As soon as any part of a person's conduct has a negative effect on the interests of others, society has jurisdiction over it, and the question whether or not the general welfare will be promoted by interfering with it becomes open to discussion. But there is no room for raising any such question when a person's conduct affects the interests of no one but himself, or needn't affect others unless they want it to. In all such cases, there should be perfect freedom, legal and social, to perform the action and accept the consequences. It would be a great misunderstanding of this doctrine to suppose that it is one of selfish indifference, claiming that human beings have no concern with each other's behaviour, and shouldn't concern themselves about one another's well-doing or well-being, unless their own interests are involved. Instead of any lessening, there is a need for a great increase of unselfish effort to promote the good of others. But it is one thing to act on one's belief that it would be better for X himself if he didn't do Y, and another to bring legal or social pressure on him not to do Y. To persuade people to look after themselves, unselfish benevolence can find instruments other than whips and scourges, whether of the literal or the metaphorical sort. I am the last person to undervalue the self-regarding virtues. They are second in importance only to the social virtues, if even second. It is equally the business of education to cultivate both. But even education works by conviction and persuasion, as well as by compulsion. And once the period of education is passed, it is only by conviction and persuasion that the self-regarding virtues should be instilled. Human beings owe each other help to distinguish the better from the worse, and encouragement to choose the better. They should be for ever stimulating each other to increase exercise of their higher faculties, an increased direction of their feelings and aims towards things and thoughts that are wise instead of foolish, elevating instead of degrading. But no one person or group is entitled to say to another adult human being that he shall not do with his life, for his own benefit, what he chooses to do with it. He is the person most interested in his own well-being, except in cases of strong personal attachment. The interest that anyone else can have in it is trifling compared with his own, and society's interest in him as an individual, except regarding his conduct toward others, is fractional and altogether indirect. And there is also a point about the knowledge interference would have to be based on. The most ordinary man or woman has means of knowledge concerning his own feelings and circumstances that immeasurably surpass what anyone else can have. But the interference of society to overrule his judgment and purposes in what affects only himself must be based not only on knowledge about him in particular, but on general presumptions about people as a whole. These general presumptions may be altogether wrong, and even when they are right, they are as likely as not to be misapplied to individual cases. In this department of human affairs, therefore, individuality has its proper field of action. In the conduct of human beings towards one another, it is necessary that general rules should mostly be observed, so that people can know what to expect. But in each person's own concerns, his individual spontaneity is entitled to free exercise. Others may offer, even push, considerations to aid his judgment and urgings to strengthen his will, but he is the final judge. Any errors that he is likely to commit, against advice and warning, are far outweighed by the evil of allowing others to constrain him to what they think to be his good. I don't mean that a person's self-regarding qualities or deficiencies shouldn't affect how others regard him. That is neither possible nor desirable. If he is conspicuous in any of the qualities that conduce to his own good, he is to that extent a proper object of admiration. He is that much nearer to the ideal perfection of human nature. If he is grossly lacking in those qualities, he will evoke the opposite of admiration. There is a degree of folly, and of what may be called lowness or depravity of taste, which, though it can't justify harming the person who manifests it, makes him necessarily and properly the object of distaste, and in extreme cases the object of contempt. Though not doing wrong to anyone else, a person may so act as to compel us to judge him to be a fool or an inferior being, and to feel towards him in that way. And since this judgment and feeling are something he would prefer to avoid, it is doing him a favour to warn him of it beforehand, as it would be to warn him of any other disagreeable consequence he is risking. It would indeed be a good thing if this service were given much more freely than today's common notions of politeness permit, and if one person could honestly point out to someone else that he thinks he is at fault, without being considered pushy or bad-mannered. We also have a right in various ways to act on our unfavourable opinion of anyone, not oppressing his individuality, but exercising ours. We are not bound, for example, to seek his society. We have a right to avoid it, though not to parade the avoidance, for we have a right to choose the society most acceptable to us. We have a right, and possibly even a duty, to warn others against him, if we think his example or conversation likely to have a bad effect on those he associates with. When we have at our disposal various possibilities of giving help, we may prefer to help others rather than him, unless it is a question of helping him to improve. In these different ways, a person may suffer very severe penalties at the hands of others, for faults that directly concern only himself. But he suffers these penalties only as natural and spontaneous consequences of the faults themselves, not because they are purposely inflicted on him for the sake of punishment. A person who shows rashness, obstinacy, self-conceit, who cannot live within moderate means, who cannot restrain himself from hurtful indulgences, who pursues animal pleasures at the expense of those of feeling and intellect, must expect to be lowered in the opinion of others, and to have a smaller share of their favourable sentiments, and has no right to complain of this, unless through some special excellence in his social relations he has deserved their favour. What I contend is this. With regard to the part of someone's conduct and character that concerns his own good, but doesn't affect the interests of others in their relations with him, the only inconveniences that he should be subject to are ones that are strictly inseparable from the unfavourable judgment of others. Acts injurious to others require a totally different treatment. Encroachment on the rights of others, infliction on them of any loss or damage not justified by his own rights, falsehood or trickery in dealing with them, unfair or ungenerous use of advantages over them, even selfish abstinence from defending them against harm, these are fit objects of moral reproach, and, in serious cases, of moral retribution and punishment. And not only these acts, but also the dispositions that lead to them, are strictly immoral, and are fit objects of disapproval that may rise to the level of disgust. Cruelty of disposition, malice and ill nature, envy, that most antisocial and odious of all passions, hypocrisy and insincerity, irritability over trifles, immoderate resentment, the love of domineering over others, the desire to get more than one share of advantages, the pride that is gratified by the abasement of others, the egotism that thinks self and its concerns more important than everything else, and decides all doubtful questions in his own favour. These are moral vices, and constitute a bad and odious moral character. Not so the self-regarding faults previously mentioned. They are not strictly immoralities, and however intense they are, they don't constitute wickedness. They may be proofs of any amount of folly or lack of personal dignity and self-respect, but they invite moral condemnation only when they lead the individual to fail in his duties to others. What are called duties to ourselves are not socially obligatory, unless circumstances turn them into duties to others as well. The phrase, duty to oneself, when it means anything more than prudence, means self-respect or self-development. And there is no "it's for the good of mankind" reason why anyone should be held accountable to his fellow creatures for either of them. The distinction between the loss of regard a person may rightly incur through a lack of prudence or personal dignity, and the condemnation due to him for an offence against the rights of others, is not merely verbal. It makes a vast difference in our feelings and conduct towards him, whether he displeases us in things in which we think we have a right to control him, or in things in which we know we haven't. If he displeases us, we may express our distaste, and we may keep our distance from a person, as well as from a thing, that displeases us. But we shan't therefore feel called on to make his life uncomfortable. We shall reflect that he already bears, or will bear, the whole penalty of his error. If he spoils his life by mismanagement, that won't lead us to want to spoil it still further. Instead of wishing to punish him, we'll try to lighten his punishment by showing him how to avoid or cure the evils brought about by his conduct. He may be to us an object of pity, perhaps of dislike, but not of anger or resentment. We shan't treat him like an enemy of society. If we don't interfere benevolently by showing interest or concern for him, the worst we shall think we are justified in doing is leaving him to himself. The situation is entirely different if he has infringed the rules necessary for the protection of his fellow creatures, individually or collectively. For then the evil consequences of his acts fall not on himself, but on others, and society, as the protector of all its members, must strike back at him, inflicting pain for the express purpose of punishment, and must ensure that the pain is severe enough. In this latter case, he is an offender in our court, and we are called on not only to sit in judgment on him, but, in one way or another, to carry out our own sentence, whereas, in the former case, it is not our role to inflict any suffering on him, except what may incidentally follow from our regulating our own affairs with the same liberty we allow him in regulating his. Many people will deny that we can distinguish the part of a person's life that concerns only himself from the part that concerns others. They may say, "How can any part of the conduct of a member of society be a matter of indifference to the other members? No person is an entirely isolated being. It is impossible for a person to do anything seriously or permanently hurtful to himself without harm coming to those closely connected with him, and perhaps to others. If he injures his property, he does harm to those who directly or indirectly derived support from it, and usually lessens somewhat the general resources of the community. If he worsens his physical or mental abilities, he not only brings evil on all who at all depend on him for their happiness, but makes himself unable to perform the services he owes to his fellow creatures generally, perhaps becomes a burden on their affection or benevolence. Finally, if by his vices or follies a person does no direct harm to others, he nevertheless does do harm by the example he sets, and he ought to be compelled to control himself for the sake of those who might be corrupted or misled by seeing or knowing of his conduct. We all agree that children and young people should be protected against themselves. So isn't society equally bound to protect against themselves adults who are equally incapable of self-government? If gambling, or drunkenness, or sexual license, or idleness, or uncleanliness are as injurious to happiness and as great a hindrance to improvement as many or most of the acts prohibited by law, why shouldn't the law also try to put them down, as far as practicability and social convenience allow? And as a supplement to the unavoidable imperfections of law, shouldn't public opinion at least organize a powerful guard against these vices, and rigorously apply social penalties on those who are known to practice them? There is no question here of restricting individuality or blocking trials of new and original experiments in living. Nothing is being prevented except things that have been tried and condemned from the beginning of the world until now, things that experience has shown not to be useful or suitable to any person's individuality. There must be some length of time and amount of experience after which a moral or prudential truth can be regarded as established. All that is proposed here is to prevent generation after generation from falling over the same precipice that has been fatal to their predecessors. I fully admit that the harm a person does to himself may seriously affect, through both their sympathies and their interests, those closely connected with him, and may to a lesser degree affect society in general. When this conduct leads a person to violate a distinct and particular obligation to any others, the case is no longer a merely self-regarding one, and becomes vulnerable to moral condemnation, in the proper sense of the term. For example, if through intemperance or extravagance a man becomes unable to pay his debts, or to support and educate his family, he is deservedly condemned, and might be justly punished. But it is for the breach of duty to his family or creditors, not for the extravagance. If the resources that ought to have been devoted to them had instead been spent on the most prudent investment, the moral culpability would have been the same. Again, if, as often happens, a man causes grief to his family by his addiction to bad habits, he deserves reproach for his unkindness or ingratitude, but he may deserve it just as much if he causes grief to his family by cultivating habits that are not in themselves vicious. When a person's purely self-regarding conduct prevents him from performing some definite duty he has towards the public, he is guilty of a social offence. No one ought to be punished simply for being drunk, but a soldier or a policeman should be punished for being drunk on duty. In short, whenever there is definite damage or risk of damage, either to an individual or to the public, the case is taken out of the domain of liberty and placed in that of morality or law. But with regard to the merely contingent harm that a person causes to society by conduct that doesn't violate any specific duty to the public, or bring harm to any assignable individual except himself, this inconvenience is one that society can afford to bear for the sake of the greater good of human freedom. But I don't assume that society has no means of bringing its weaker members up to its ordinary standard of rational conduct, except waiting till they do something irrational, and then punishing them for it, legally or morally. Society has had absolute power over them during all the early part of their existence. It has had the whole period of childhood and adolescence, in which to try to make them capable of rational conduct later on. The existing adult generation is master both of the training and the entire circumstances of the next generation. Indeed, it can't make them perfectly wise and good, because it is itself so lamentably short of goodness and wisdom, and its best efforts are not always, in individual cases, its most successful ones. But it is perfectly well able to make the rising generation, as a whole, as good as itself, and a little better. If society lets any considerable number of its members grow up as mere children, incapable of being acted on by rational consideration of long-term consequences, society has itself to blame for the upshot. Armed not only with all the powers of education, but also with the way publicly accepted opinion always dominates the minds of those who are least able to judge for themselves, and aided also by the penalties that inevitably fall on those who incur the distaste or the contempt of those who know them, let society not claim that besides all this, it needs the power to issue commands and enforce obedience in the personal concerns of individuals. And nothing tends more to discredit and frustrate the better means of influencing conduct than a resort to the worse. If those we are trying to coerce into prudence or temperance include any who are made of the same stuff as vigorous and independent characters, they will certainly rebel against the yoke. No such person will ever feel that others have a right to control him in his concerns. The kind of right that they do have to prevent him from harming them and their concerns. And it easily comes to be considered a mark of spirit and courage to fly in the face of such illegitimate authority, ostentatiously doing the exact opposite of what it commands. But the strongest of all the arguments against the public's interfering with purely personal conduct is that when it does interfere, the odds are that it interferes wrongly and in the wrong place. On questions of social morality, of duty to others, the opinion of the overruling majority is likely to be right oftener than it is wrong, because on such questions they are only required to judge how a given mode of conduct, if allowed to be practiced, would affect their interests. But the opinion of a similar majority imposed as a law on the minority on questions of self-regarding conduct is as likely to be wrong as right. For in these cases, public opinion means at best some people's opinion of what is good or bad for other people. And often it doesn't even mean that, because the public consider only their own preference and don't care about the pleasure or convenience of those whose conduct they censure. Many people regard conduct they dislike as an insult to themselves, and resent it as an outrage to their feelings. As a religious bigot, when accused of disregarding the religious feelings of others, has been known to reply that they disregard his feelings by persisting in their abominable worship or creed. But a person's feeling for his own opinion is not on a par with the feeling of someone else, who is offended at his holding it, any more than a person's desire to keep his purse is on a par with a thief's desire to take it. Someone's taste is as much his own particular concern as is his opinion or his purse. It is easy for anyone to imagine an ideal public that leaves individuals free to choose in all matters where there are two sides to the question, and only requires them to abstain from kinds of conduct that universal experience has condemned. But whoever saw a public that did set any such limit to its censorship? And when does the public trouble itself about universal experience? In its interferences with personal conduct, the public is seldom thinking of anything but the dreadfulness of anyone's acting or feeling differently from itself. And this standard of judgment is what 90% of all moralists and moral theorists hold up to mankind as the dictate of religion and philosophy. The standard in question is thinly disguised in the hands of these people. What they openly teach is that things are right because they are right, because we feel them to be so. They tell us to search in our own minds and hearts for laws of conduct binding on ourselves and on all others. what can the poor public do but apply these instructions and make their own personal feelings of good and evil, if they are reasonably unanimous in them, obligatory on all the world? The evil that I am pointing out here doesn't exist only in theory, and you may expect me to cite examples in which the public of this age and country improperly dresses up its own preferences as moral laws. It isn't hard to show by abundant examples that one of the most universal of all human tendencies is the extension of the bounds of what may be called moral police, until it encroaches on the most unquestionably legitimate liberty of the individual. Examples of this will occupy the remainder of the present chapter. As a first instance, consider the hostilities that men feel simply because persons whose religious opinions are different from theirs don't practice their religious observances, especially their religious abstinences. To cite a rather trivial example, nothing in the creed or practice of Christians does more to make Muslims hate them than eating pork. There are few acts that Christians and Europeans regard with more sincere disgust than Muslims regard this way of satisfying hunger. It is, in the first place, an offence against their religion. But this doesn't explain either the degree or the kind of their repugnance, for wine also is forbidden by their religion. And Muslims all think it is wrong to drink wine, but they don't think it is disgusting. In contrast, their aversion to the flesh of the unclean beast has that special character, like an instinctive revulsion, which the idea of uncleanness, once it thoroughly sinks into the feelings, seems always to excite, even in those whose personal habits are anything but scrupulously clean. A remarkable example of this force of the idea of uncleanness is provided by the sentiment of religious impurity that is so intense in the Hindus. Suppose now that in a majority Muslim country, the majority refused to allow pork to be eaten within the limits of the country. This would be nothing new in Muslim countries. Would it be a legitimate exercise of the moral authority of public opinion? And if not, why not? The practice is really revolting to such a public. They also sincerely think it to be forbidden and abhorred by God. Neither could the prohibition be censured as religious persecution. It might be religious in its origin, but it wouldn't be persecution for religion, since nobody's religion makes it a duty to eat pork. The only tenable ground for condemning it would be that the public has no business interfering with the personal tastes and self-regarding concerns of individuals. To come somewhat nearer home, most Spaniards consider it a gross impiety, offensive in the highest degree to the Supreme Being, to worship him in any but the Roman Catholic way. And no other public worship is lawful on Spanish soil. The people of all southern Europe look on a married clergy as not only irreligious, but unchaste, indecent, gross, disgusting. What do Protestants think of these perfectly sincere feelings, and of the attempt to enforce them against non-Catholics? Yet, if mankind are justified in interfering with each other's liberty, in matters that don't involve the interests of others, on what principle can these cases be consistently excluded? Or who can blame people for wanting to suppress what they regard as a scandal in the sight of God and man? No stronger case can be shown for prohibiting anything that is regarded as a personal immorality than is made out for suppressing these practices, in the eyes of those who regard them as impieties. And unless we are willing to adopt the logic of persecutors, and to say that we may persecute others because we are right, and they must not persecute us because they are wrong, we must beware of admitting the principle whose application to ourselves we would resent as a gross injustice. Those examples may be objected to, although unreasonably, as drawn from situations that couldn't arise among us, because in this country public opinion isn't likely to enforce abstinence from meats, or to interfere with people for worshipping, or for marrying, or not marrying, according to their creed or inclination. My next example, however, will involve an interference with liberty that we have by no means passed all danger of. Wherever the Puritans have been sufficiently powerful, as in New England and in Great Britain at the time of Cromwell, they have tried with considerable success to put down all public and most private amusements, especially music, dancing, public games, and the theatre. In this country there are still many people whose notions of morality and religion condemn these recreations, and those people belong chiefly to the middle class, which is the dominant power in the present social and political condition of the kingdom, so that it is by no means impossible that people with these views may some day command a majority in Parliament. How will the rest of the community like having the amusements that shall be permitted to them regulated by the religious and moral sentiments of the stricter Calvinists and Methodists? Wouldn't they pretty abruptly tell these intrusively pious members of society to mind their own business? Well, that is precisely what should be said to every government and every public who claim that no person shall enjoy any pleasure that they think is wrong. Once the principle of that claim is admitted, no one can reasonably object to its being acted on in the spirit of the dominant power in the country, and everyone must be ready to conform to the idea of a Christian commonwealth as understood by the early settlers in New England, if a religious creed similar to theirs should ever succeed in regaining its lost ground. And religions, supposedly in decline, have regained lost ground. In our own day, gross intrusions on the liberty of private life are actually practised, still greater ones are threatened with some expectation of success, and opinions are presented that would license the public not only to prohibit by law everything it thinks wrong, but also, in order to get at what it thinks wrong, to prohibit any number of things it admits to be innocent. Under the name of preventing intemperance, the people of one English colony and of nearly half the United States have been forbidden by an 1851 law to use alcoholic drinks for anything but medical purposes. For prohibition of their sale, which is what is explicitly forbidden by law, acts as a prohibition of their use, and is intended as such. And though the impracticability of enforcing the law has caused its repeal in several of the states that had adopted it, including the state of Maine, from which it derives its name, many professed philanthropists have zealously started to agitate for a similar law in this country. The so-called alliance that has been formed for this purpose has acquired some notoriety through the publicity given to a correspondence between its secretary and Lord Stanley, one of the very few English public men who hold that a politician's opinions ought to be founded on principles. The spokesman for the alliance, who would deeply deplore the recognition of any principle that could be wrenched around so as to justify bigotry and persecution, points out the broad and impassable barrier that divides such principles from those of his association. "All matters relating to thought, opinion, conscience appear to me," he says, "to lie outside the sphere of legislation. All matters pertaining to social acts and habits appear to me to be within that sphere." He doesn't mention a third class, different from either of these, namely acts and habits that are not social but individual. Although it is to this class, surely, that the act of drinking alcoholic liquors belongs. Selling such liquors, however, is trading, and trading is a social act. But the infringement complained of is not on the liberty of the seller, but on that of the buyer and consumer, since the state might just as well forbid him to drink wine as purposely make it impossible for him to obtain it. The secretary of the alliance, however, says, "I claim as a citizen a right to legislate whenever my social rights are invaded by the social act of another." Now for the definition of these social rights. "If anything invades my social rights, certainly the traffic in strong drink does. It destroys my primary right of security by constantly creating and stimulating social disorder. It invades my right of equality by making a profit out of the creation of misery that I am taxed to support. It impedes my right to free moral and intellectual development by surrounding my path with dangers, and by weakening and demoralizing society, from which I have a right to claim mutual aid and personal relationships. This is a theory of social rights, the like of which has probably never before been stated clearly. It is nothing short of this, that it is my absolute social right that every other individual shall act in every respect exactly as he ought, that whoever fails in the least detail of this violates my social right and entitles me to demand that the legislature remove the grievance. This monstrous principle is far more dangerous than any single interference with liberty. There is no violation of liberty that it wouldn't justify. It acknowledges no right to any freedom whatever, except perhaps the freedom to hold opinions in secret without ever disclosing them. For the moment an opinion that I consider poisonous passes anyone's lips, it invades all the social rights attributed to me by the Alliance. The doctrine ascribes to all mankind a vested interest in each other's moral, intellectual, and even physical perfection, to be defined by each claimant according to his own standard. Another important example of illegitimate interference with the rightful liberty of the individual, not simply threatened but long since triumphantly achieved, is legislation concerning the Sabbath. Refraining from one's usual daily occupations on one day of the week, as far as is practically possible, is no doubt a highly beneficial custom, though it is in no respect religiously binding on any except Jews. And it can't be followed without a general consent to that effect among the classes of people with jobs to do, because if some people follow it, that compels others to do so. It may therefore be allowable and right that the law should guarantee to each person the observance by others of the custom in question, by suspending the large-scale operations of the economy on a particular day. But this justification is based on the direct interest that others have in each individual's observance of the practice, so it doesn't apply to the leisure-time occupations that a person chooses to engage in, nor does it hold good in the slightest degree for legal restrictions on amusements. It is true that the amusement of some is the day's work of others, but the labour of a few is compensated for by the pleasure of the many, and by the good their recreation does for them, provided that the few freely choose their work and are free to give it up. The workers are perfectly right in thinking that if everyone worked on Sunday, 7 days' work would have to be given for 6 days' wages. But so long as the great mass of employments are suspended, the small number, who must still work for the enjoyment of others, obtain a proportional increase of earnings, and they aren't obliged to follow those occupations if they would rather have leisure than pay, or a remedy might be found in the establishment of a holiday on some other day of the week, for those folk in particular. So the only ground on which restrictions on Sunday amusements can be defended must be that they are religiously wrong, and this is a motive of legislation that never can be too earnestly protested against. Injuries to the gods are the gods' business, as Tacitus said. It remains to be proved that society, or anyone acting for it, has been appointed by heaven to avenge any supposed offence to God that isn't also a wrong to our fellow creatures. The notion that it is one man's duty that another should be religious was the basis for all the religious persecutions ever perpetrated, and if it were right, it would fully justify them. The feeling that pushes the repeated attempts to stop railway travel on Sunday, the resistance to opening museums, and the like, doesn't have the cruelty of the persecutors of old, but the state of mind indicated by it is fundamentally the same as theirs. It is a determination not to tolerate others in doing what their religion permits, because the persecutor's religion doesn't. It is a belief that God not only abominates the act of the misbeliever, but will blame us if we don't interfere with him. To these examples of the small regard commonly paid to human liberty, I can't help adding one more: the language of downright persecution that breaks out from the press of this country, whenever it wants to say something about Mormonism. Much might be said concerning the unexpected and instructive fact that an alleged new revelation, and a religion based on it, the product of obvious fraud, and not even supported by the prestige of extraordinary qualities in its founder, is believed by hundreds of thousands of people, and has been made the foundation of a whole society, in the age of newspapers, railways, and the electric telegraph. What here concerns us is that this religion, like other and better ones, has its martyrs, that its prophet and founder was, for his teaching, put to death by a mob, that others of its adherents lost their lives by the same lawless violence, that they were forcibly expelled, in a body, from their first territory, and now that they have been chased into a solitary recess, in the middle of a desert, many in this country openly declare that it would be right, though not convenient, to send an expedition to force them to conform to the opinions of other people. The item in the Mormon doctrine that chiefly arouses this hostility, which breaks through the ordinary restraints of religious tolerance, is its acceptance of polygamy. Though permitted to Moslems, Hindus, and Chinese, this seems to arouse unquenchable animosity when practiced by people who speak English and claim to be some kind of Christian. No one disapproves of this Mormon institution more deeply than I do. Far from being in any way countenanced by the principle of liberty, it directly infringes that principle. It merely rivets the chains of one half of the community, while freeing the other half from any corresponding obligation. And there are other reasons against it also. Still, it must be remembered that this relation is as much voluntary on the part of the women involved, who may be regarded as its victims, as is the case with any other form of the marriage institution. This may seem surprising, but it has its explanation in the common ideas and customs of the world, which teach women to think of marriage as the one thing they need. This makes it intelligible that many a woman should prefer being one of several wives to not being a wife at all. Other countries are not asked to recognize such unions, or to release any of their inhabitants from their own laws, on the ground that they have Mormon beliefs. But when the dissentients, the Mormons, have conceded to the hostile attitudes of others, far more than those others were entitled to demand, and when they have left the territories where their doctrines were unacceptable, and settled in a remote corner of the earth, that they have been the first to make habitable to human beings, it's hard to see on what principles but those of tyranny they can be prevented from living there, under what laws they please, provided they commit no aggression against other nations, and allow those who are dissatisfied with their ways to leave. A recent writer, who is in some respects a person of considerable merit, proposes not a crusade, but what he calls a civilizade, a war in the service not of the cross, but of civilization, against this polygamous community, to put an end to what seems to him a step backwards in civilization. To me, too, that is what it seems to be, but I'm not aware that any community has the right to force another to be civilized. As long as those who suffer through the bad law don't call for help from other communities, I can't accept that persons entirely unconnected with them ought to step in and require that a state of affairs that all who are directly involved appear to be satisfied with should be put an end to, because it scandalizes people some thousands of miles away, people who have no part or concern in it. Let them send missionaries, if they please, to preach against it, and let them by any fair means, of which silencing the teachers is not one, oppose the progress of similar doctrines among their own people. If civilization gained the upper hand over barbarism, when barbarism had the world to itself, it is absurd to claim to be afraid that barbarism, after having been fairly put down, might revive and conquer civilization. A civilization that could thus be beaten by its vanquished enemy must already have become so degenerate that neither its appointed priests and teachers nor anybody else is able to stand up for it, or anyway will take the trouble to do so. In that case, the sooner such a civilization receives notice to quit, the better. It can only go from bad to worse, until it is destroyed and regenerated, like the western part of the Roman Empire, by energetic barbarians. End of chapter 4.